Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
We always say that one of the most important off seasons in your entire career is the one between your first and your second year. You're no longer a rookie. You have a year under your belt. And by now, you know how everything works. You know what it takes to compete at the highest level. You understand the expectations and what it takes to meet them. So, how do you spend that first offseason? Every player in that position has to ask himself that question. And it's a critical question. One of the most important of all, how do you spend your first offseason? Well, if you're New York Giants cornerback, DeAndre Baker, you commit armed robbery in Florida. Allegedly, Miramar police issued an arrest warrant for Baker on 4 counts of armed robbery with a firearm and 4 counts of aggravated assault with a firearm. And he's not the only one. Seattle Seahawks cornerback Quentin Dunbar is wanted on 4 counts of armed robbery with a firearm as well. So instead of linking up with vets to train, Baker linked up with a vet to commit armed robbery, allegedly. 2 current NFL cornerbacks being accused of armed robbery is crazy. Yet that's not even the craziest part. It gets much crazier. It gets much, much better. Starting with the fact that Baker was a first-round pick last year. He was the Giants' first-round pick in April of 2019, and he's allegedly committing armed robbery in May of 2020. Man, you want to talk about a fun fact? You want to talk about a fun fact? That's already one of my favorite stats of all time. From being a first-round pick to a guy picked up for armed robbery, allegedly, in just over 1 year. That is not easy to do. But apparently, DeAndre Baker has pulled off the impossible. Allegedly. GOAT. I mean, this is not some dude who bombed out of the league, fell on hard times, and then resurfaced a few years later on police blotter. This is a guy who was playing against the Eagles less than 5 months ago. And allegedly robbing dudes less than 3 days ago. He's a first-round pick. And not just a first-round pick, but a guy that the Giants gave up 3 picks to trade up to get. So as always, incredible work by you, Dave Gettleman. And as you might expect, the details of the arrest warrant are an all-time read. It reads like this. Baker and Dunbar were at a party in Miramar Wednesday night. The party gets underway at about 8 p.m. According to the arrest warrant, quote, numerous individuals were in attendance. Let me stop right there. I do have some concerns about the physical distancing issues at a party where, quote, numerous individuals were in attendance. However, as always, that's another matter altogether. Now, the host of the party stated under oath that he was outside cooking food when he heard a commotion inside. According to the warrant, when the host looked inside, quote, he observed DeAndre Lamar Baker with a gun in his hand. Baker was pointing it at one of the attendees of the party, end quote. If they're going with the government, somebody got issued a warrant for an arrest. If your middle name is a part of the story, you did something wrong, allegedly. So this guy's out back cooking, and he looks inside, and my man's got a gun, allegedly. Well, that certainly escalated quickly. My man's probably flipping a few burgers on the grill, thinking, man, I am just killing the party game again. Only to see an NFLer inside bowing up like he's going to kill someone if he doesn't get their valuables. Allegedly. Because the host alleges that, quote, Baker was directing 2 other individuals to take money and valuables from other attendees, end quote. The host says that Dunbar was one of the individuals assisting Baker in taking the money and the valuables. Baker told the 3rd individual, who was wearing a red mask, to take $800 and an $18,000 Rolex from the host. According to the host, Baker, quote, directed the assailant in the red mask to shoot. Another individual, quote, who was just walking into the party, end quote. Man, there is so much to unpack there. Like, dude, can you imagine if red mask guy actually followed the kill order? Yo, take money and watch from that guy and shoot that guy. Also, what are you thinking if you're the individual walking into a party and the first thing you're greeted with is somebody telling somebody else to shoot you? You're just rolling into a party on a Wednesday night during the quarantine, looking to hang out, maybe blow off a little bit of steam. You hear about this banging party. A couple of NFLers might be there. You're 1 foot in the door, and one of those NFLers is instructing some other dude to bust a cap in you, allegedly. Fortunately for that late arriving guest, he was able to leave with his life, but not his cash and not his ticker. He told police that Red Mask robbed him of $7,000 in cash and a Hublot valued at $25,000. That's a hell of a party, man. That is one hell of a terrible party. Show up, get a Glock pointed right at you, and $32,000 worth of cash and merchandise stolen from you. Man, this party sucks. 0-star review. Will not go back, ever. But there's more. Another person who was interviewed for the arrest warrant had more deets. This person said that at the party, people were playing cards, people were gambling, and playing video games. At one point, an argument ensued at the card table, and Baker, along with another person, identified as Shy, quote, flipped over the table, pulled out guns, and put them in someone's face, end quote.
Right in my face.
Hey, look, nobody loves a good nickname more than me, and nobody hates self-glossing more than me. And, man, I don't think that Shy, I don't know if Shy dropped that handle on himself or if somebody else gave it to him, but I do know this. There's nothing shy about flipping over a table and putting a gun in somebody's face. Like, my man is no introvert. He should not be walking around telling people, yo, man, yo, I'm Shy. What's your name? Who is his wingman? Timid? Was Timid rocking a machine gun? Was their boy Bashful looking to roll a tank into the living room? So this witness was robbed of $4,000 in cash and an Audemars Piguet worth $17,500. Not to flex on anybody or to go all D-bag, but many of you know I'm a watch guy. I'm a watch guy that feels strongly about his opinion. It says right here, AP is the finest timepiece you can buy. Trust me, that dude felt really good about walking into that party, rocking that ticker, only to have it ripped off his wrist the second he got through the door by an NFLer and his crew, allegedly. He also stated that Baker and Dunbar, 2 days earlier, were at a different party and they lost roughly $70,000. Now we're getting somewhere. Why would two NFLers come to a party packing heat, looking to rob people, allegedly? Maybe because they lost $70,000 of their own dough a couple of days earlier at another party. There's still more. There always is, right? A fourth witness was interviewed and said that Baker pointed a gun at him and demanded all his money. He gave Baker $600 and a watch, a Richard Mille. But it was a knockoff. It was valued at $600. Man, how much did that sting? How much did that hurt? Getting robbed of $600 in cash is horrible. Having somebody point a gun at you has got to be pretty traumatizing. But how about having to tell the cops that your watch was fake? Everybody else at that party is rocking their Rolex, their Hublots, their APs. My man walks in there with his Richard Mille feeling good about himself. Only to find out it was a big lie, man. You're living a lie. It was fake. Why not just say it was a Casio? It's a Timex. You know he didn't want that in the police report. You know he didn't want that getting out. You know that was so much worse for his look and his psyche than being held up at gunpoint. Having a gun to his head was traumatizing, but not nearly as bad as everybody else at that party finding out that his meal was fake. That's something that dude will never get over. Just saying. Remember, I'm a watch guy. It's fake. It's worth $5. So let me just recap this very quickly, because I know that I put a lot out there. What we have here so far is a New York Giants first-round pick from last year, a Seattle Seahawks cornerback, and the two of them are accused of going to a party and robbing the guests at this party of more than $73,000 in cash and watches. One of the best stories ever already, But how do you go next level with it? Check this. The three individuals fled the scene in three separate getaway cars. So you're probably thinking, what kind of cars were those? Unmarked white vans? Rental cars? Cars that would just blend in? Not really. One was a Beamer, one was a Benz, and the third was, wait for it, a Lamborghini. A freaking getaway Lambo. Who are you, Thomas Crown? Is this real life or a Nick Cage movie?
Okay, let's run.
Who shows up to a party, commits armed robbery, and then leaves in a Lambo? Way to be inconspicuous. I wonder if it was like one of those lime green Lambos. I see them all the time down where I live. And that's not like some flex either. I just live in kind of a car area. If you're in a Lambo, it's lime green. Believe me. A lime green car. Before you come up here and say nobody shows up at a party in a Lambo preparing to rob it, you are wrong. Because according to multiple witnesses, the cars were, quote, pre-positioned outside the residence in a manner that would facilitate an expedited departure. They picked up those three cars to be their getaway cars, and they parked them so they could make a quick getaway. So good. The thing about this story is, it's already one of the most amazing things I've ever heard, but it gets even more ridiculous because we haven't even gotten to Dunbar's part yet. That needs its own take. I love everything about this story except for the fact that I was not there. Man, I want to go to a party where active NFLers can rob me and my friends at gunpoint, allegedly. If any of you know of a rager like that's about to go down, hit me up. Shoot me the invite. I'm in. I will even put on one of my best tickers for it. We'll break out the good stuff. Imagine being at a party and a guy's got a gun. Hey, man, give me your money. Give me your watch. Dude, weren't you a first-round draft pick like last year? Shut up, man. Give me your fake Rolex.
Give me back my
fake Rolex.
It's all in a police report.
And surprisingly, this happened in Florida. Patrick Corbin is my guest. Patrick, I want to talk to you about the Call of Duty tournament that you're hosting with Matt Barnes of the Red Sox in a minute, as well as everything else you've got going on. But first off, how are you and everybody around you doing during this most unusual time, Patrick?
Yeah, thanks for having me. We're doing, I think, as best as anyone can at these times, these strange times, and just trying to stay busy as best we can and try to do some good for some people who are in need.
Excellent. Listen, you and I spoke right after the World Series last year. If you could take one more look back for me, as you look back on that time and on that team, what kind of memories do you have?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, now just being at home, you miss your teammates, you miss the coaching staff, you miss going to the ballpark every day, and those are things that I'll always remember and how special last season was. And things are obviously different, and not being able to get up to D.C. and to see the fans and to show off our banner and to get our World Series rings is obviously something we wanted to do and wanted to do that with our fans and families and friends.
Patrick Corbin is joining us. You know, there is obviously a rhythm to life as a baseball player. And now we're in the middle of May. The season would normally be rolling along. You'd be looking to repeat as champions. What's it like not to have baseball at the moment?
Yeah, it's strange just being at home. And we're not used to this. We don't really know what to do. We're trying to stay in shape. We're trying to throw, trying to get ready for a season that happens. And I mean, I'm sure everybody's has questions, and not only in the baseball community, but in life in general and everything else going on. So these are obviously difficult times, and we're just trying to make the best out of it.
You mentioned trying to stay in shape. So how do you go about staying in shape? What have you done, and how do you go about building your arm up so you are ready when it's time to play?
Yeah, I've been able to get workouts in. That's been at least a positive for me. I've been thrown into a net a lot, so obviously it's not as similar as getting off a mound and doing things like that, but I think things out here, we're down in West Palm, are starting to ramp up a little bit where we can go throw some bullpens, meet up with some catchers and some other players and hopefully get some live batting practice in. So hopefully those things continue to happen and to make sure whenever we do start this spring training up again or practice time that we're ready to go.
Nationals pitcher Patrick Corbin joining us, World Series champion. There have been reports this week of a proposal that owners have put together for an abbreviated season, which would include an expanded postseason, the DH in the National League, a couple of other items. Based on what you've seen and heard in the proposal, what do you make of it?
Yeah, I know that the safety and health for the players has to be one of the most important steps of this, and our families and for the fans as well. And I know how much sports need to get back and how much the fans at home want to see something on TV. So obviously all these steps we have to think about and really dive deep into. And I do know that the players that I've spoke to and who are still out here training and stuff want to play as many games as we can. We want to get back on the field, and we miss baseball just as much as everyone else.
You know, Patrick, it was interesting, I thought, to see earlier this week your teammate Sean Doolittle outline some of his concerns when it comes to the health and the safety of everybody involved if there is going to be a season. And then Rays pitcher Blake Snell was on Twitch. He made it clear that he would strongly consider sitting out the year if the owners are serious about that 50-50 revenue split when the players already agreed to one reduction in salary and would be putting themselves at risk of getting COVID. What was your reaction to what Snell had to say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's obviously some good thoughts there. We are taking a risk getting back there. We did come to an agreement before, and I mean, there's so many questions that are still unanswered, and we're not sure if they even were answered the other day. So hopefully we can continue to move on from this, and we've been in contact with players from the team, the union, every day, trying to get things to work out. And I guess the main thing is we want to get out there and play. We want to play as many games as we can, obviously in a safe way. The players are taking a risk by doing this and being away from their families for a long period of time. We know that that's something that's going to have to happen. So someone's going to have to give here, and we'll see what goes on.
Like, Patrick, assuming the negotiation works out, right, assuming that you come to an agreement, in terms of the health risk, what would you need to see or hear to know that it was okay for you to go back and play in terms of the health risk itself?
Yeah, I know that the testing, I think, was a big part, and I think they're going to be able to get that done. And I'm not an expert on any of this, so obviously we're at an age where it's not as high of a risk for a lot of these players, but you do worry about the families and other people that they would like to see throughout a course of a season. So hopefully we can figure out that. And it seems like there's more and more talk each and every day about this. So hopefully they can come to a resolution here and figure what's the best way to go about this.
Yeah, one more thought about that, and then I'm going to ask you about your Call of Duty tournament. But there was this notion earlier that the players might be in a bubble of sorts. And if you went into the bubble, then you'd be separated from your family for a number of months. I'm not sure whether or not that's still a factor, but was that something that you would be willing to do in order to resume play, or is that kind of a deal breaker and you need to be near your family?
Yeah, I mean, I think some guys would do it. It's going to be hard, and these are things that obviously we're going to have to work out, and I think that's why it's important to get the players what they want and what they need for the safety for everybody that they're going to be around. We're not going to be able to have a full team in the gym throughout the season. So we got to figure things like that. If they're going to social distance us in the locker room, in the clubhouse and things like that. So there's a lot of things that we're going to have to do, but we want to be able to perform at the highest level on the field. And we need to do our workouts. We need to show up at the field at 2 p.m. for a 7 o'clock game to make sure we're ready to do things like that.
The Call of Duty tournament, Patrick, is tomorrow from noon until 3 p.m. Eastern. Where did the idea first come from, and how much Call of Duty have you been playing this offseason?
Yeah, been getting into it recently. I haven't always been a big gamer, but I think we were just trying to find a way to where we could do some good, have fans involved, and have an opportunity to do something with some of their favorite players and raise some money for people in need and for some good charities that some of these players have. And we found 16 players that agreed to play, and fans are able to bid to play for a couple hours with some of those players. So we're really looking forward to it. We're going to live stream it, and it's going to be fun.
All right, so I read off some of your baseball accomplishments at the top of the interview. You are among the best of the best. When you're playing Call of Duty online with other elite players, what is that experience like?
Yeah, I've actually, the competition part is what we love, and I think that's a big thing what we miss about baseball. But I've been so bad at Call of Duty, I've been losing some sleep over it, just kind of trying to get better. But it's all we can kind of do right now. Everybody's at home, so just trying to find ways to stay competitive, but trying to get better.
All right, listen, some of the other guys who are involved, in addition to you and Barnes, you've got J.D. Martinez, Pete Alonso, Juan Soto, Ryan Zimmerman. When you look at the other baseball players who are competing, who are the guys you have to worry about and who are the guys you do not have to worry about?
Yeah, so Trey Turner's probably on the top of that list. He's built his own computer. He's been gaming his whole life. So obviously he's a guy that you're going to want to watch out for him. And probably bid on because you're going to have a good chance to win. And I think Zimmerman might be maybe towards the end. I know he's gamed a little bit, but he just got the Xbox. He got, I think, Call of Duty about a week ago. So he's been practicing. So it's going to be fun. There'll be some bragging rights on the line. And we're looking forward to doing this on Saturday and hopefully continue to grow this and every year have it bigger and bigger.
All right, so how do the fans get involved, and where do they go to get more information?
Yeah, so I have the link for the website on my Twitter and my Instagram account, which is PatrickCorbin46, and that'll send you a direct link to make donations, see what players are on there. If you don't win one of those bids, you can also watch us live. We'll be streaming this and can make other donations that way.
Great cause. It is the Warzone Charity Royale Tournament tomorrow from 12 until 3 Eastern. Patrick Corbin, right behind that. He is a World Series champion, a two-time All-Star, and the winning pitcher, of course, in Game 7. Patrick, great to have you on. Have fun with that. Hope we can talk again soon, and hope we see some baseball soon.
Yeah, sounds good. Stay safe.
It is the season. You know it by now. If you didn't know it, then you missed yesterday's program. It's already started up in like today with Benny and Wisco. Yesterday, though, was great. Yesterday was a really good indicator that we are in the middle of the season. Let me just backtrack really quickly. In chronological order, yesterday, watch lister Johnny Scabs checked in. Chris in Toronto ripped a golden ticket yesterday. So we have more Canadian representation, except the rest of Canada was pissed because the rest of Canada hates Toronto. A number of you in Canada admitted you hate Toronto more than you hate the U.S. Those are Canadians saying that. Caleb in Green Bay got the player profile treatment. Geoff in Lincoln nuked his brain in a microwave and asked Alvin to put him out of his, quote, mystery.
Put me out of my mystery.
You're out of your mystery, Geoff.
Put me out of my mystery.
Never call again.
Mark
in Boston.
Put me out of my
mystery. Oh, Alvy, go ahead. Put me out of my mystery.
Put me out of my mystery.
Ah! Gladly. Mark in Boston. Not only called, he requested his smack-off winnings be in small bills for his local strip clubs. We ran down Canada's abhorrent 25-year history at the main event. I discussed that already again today. Jeff in SoCal made probably his best call ever, but wasn't able to finish before a hard break to get a golden ticket. He would have, but I assume because it was Jeff, he didn't need more than 90 seconds. And then on that day, he decides to make his best call ever, and he got run. Well, he ran out of time. Same thing in his case. Reggie in the OC came in. And I actually rolled out the red carpet for him because he's known on Twitter as Brad's hype man. And I wanted to see how he could do. I was actually pulling for him, except he came in here and he huffed and he puffed and then he stroked out. And he died in an all-time flame job. And is still catching a lot of heat for it today. Jeff in Southfield closed the show with an epic 2-minute run at Kyle in Green Bay. That all happened in one day. That all happened yesterday. And then when we went off the air, Stucknut went and dropped the highly anticipated odds for the event last night, which you can find on his site, Stucknut.com. So I mentioned this before also. Generally, Stucknut, not even generally, always, Stucknut has his own odds. And then sometimes actual betting sites have actual odds that you can cash. You never know from year to year whether or not that's going to happen, but you can always count on the nut. I'll get more into the odds next week because they're always a source of great controversy and content leading up to the smack-off itself. However, here are the highlights. Brad is your favorite, not surprisingly, minus 150. Leff, right behind him at the second choice, 3-1. Rick in Buffalo and Shawnee the Cowboy Nation, both 4-1. Caleb in Green Bay rounds out the top five, 5-1. There's your morning line. I think that sounds pretty legit. Sounds pretty chalky. Hey, Mike and Indy, how's that grab you? How does it feel to be looking up at those guys and Mac in Boston? And Cal, you better get up in here quickly, dude, because not only is the entire jungle calling you short, but freaking Stucknut has you looking up at Sarah T, Cal. No respect from the nut. Sarah is coming off at 16-1. Cal, you're 18-1. Anytime you want to pick up that phone, Cal, you know the number. As it stands, you're looking up at Sarah T. That's a quick recap of Thursday. Let's keep looking forward, though. Keep the momentum going. Let's continue with a player profile with a look today at the angriest, loudest, most pissed off man in the jungle, Rick in Buffalo. Rick's coming off an extremely impressive sophomore effort at Smackoff 25 last summer. In a truly great phone call from start to finish, Rick took second by the slimmest of margins, right behind Brad and Corona. No one remembers second place unless it's Rick from 2019 because it was that close. Now, what's wild about Rick is he's only been in two smack-offs. That's amazing. This guy's got the game of somebody that you think has been in the main event for decades. It feels like he's been here for decades, but he's actually really new to it. He's only been in two of these things, but you would never know it. Not by the way it feels and not by how good he is at it. Let me say this about Rick. He hates everybody. He's an equal opportunity hater. It extends beyond the jungle. Not only does he hate everybody here, he even hates his own family.
If being old, fat, and stupid is all it takes to be a major league ump, I'm going to have my old man wire his resume tomorrow. Three Raptors fans in May turned into 3 million diehards in June. My skank mother-in-law even went up for the parade. This drunk bitch is going on 70 and still wants to party like it's Woodstock 69. And there's no bigger a-hole Yankee fan out there than my old man.
I didn't bring my entire family, just my wife and my girlfriend.
Ever since the first time I played catch with my old man, I've had a deep affinity for lovable fat guys. More road rage with the kids in the back seat. It's never too early to teach them not to take crap from anyone.
That is a brand that is exclusive to Rick. Going in on his dad. Going in on his mother-in-law. Talking about cheating on the wife, teaching his kids road rage. I love it, and it's awesome. But many of you don't love Rick. Many of you hate this guy. Many of you hate this guy as much as he hates you because you think that he ripped Jeff from Richmond's act. In case you were not around in 2018, he already addressed that 2 years back.
I've sounded this way since I was five, and I've been pulling older chicks ever since. And are you really dumb enough to believe I'd model my game after that broken down train wreck? You heard that call yesterday. Jeff sounded like he just woke up from a 10-year nap and then accidentally butt-dialed the show. His timing was off, his material dated, and just when you thought it couldn't get any worse, he shouts out to his boy, Rogan Loam. Nice touch, Jeffrey. Now let me give you the real update on Jeff in Richmond. He traded in those 26-inch pipes for a 52-inch waistline. His mannerly countryside estate went into foreclosure in 2008, and his once-trophy wife now resides in my bedroom.
This guy. Hope that clears it up for everybody. I know Rick does not care if it does or it doesn't, because he hasn't looked back since then. He checks in early and often. This guy's not hard to find, and I appreciate the hell out of that. This dude does not hoard or Hyde. He's been in once a month or more, and it's been like that for over 3 years now. Here is some of what the last 3 years have sounded like from Rick.
John in New York. I love how this loser starts every one of his calls saying the show's so funny, he almost drives his truck right off the road. Hey, John, do us all a favor and finish the job. Your wife will secretly celebrate, and your kids will be a lot better off. I may sound like I'm 80, but I got the robustness and bedroom prowess of a 20-year-old. Just ask Vic and NoCal's old lady. She'll be thrilled to tell you all about it. What's wrong, Left? Another writer's strike in Southern California. Nobody can hold a candle to Kyle Brandt. Good morning, football. Are you kidding me, dude? I tell you what I think, but like every other football fan, I've never seen the show. Now, I realize you feel pity for Canada Jim, so I know you're going to take their smack-off calls, but could you kindly take them back-to-back at the bottom of hour two? That'll give me a chance to drop a nice mid-show deucer and restock the cooler without missing a friggin' thing. I'm flying so high today, Jim. Not even the sight of Hawk's ugly face can bring me down. Fix no longer the Broadway Joe guaranteeing Super Bowl win. He's the drunken idiot throwing himself all over Susie Colbert. Fix like the old family dog who you finally got to put down. You feel terrible about it, but when all he's doing is running into walls and peeing on the carpet, there's no other choice. You loser. You hack. You fat ass. You sociopath. You scumbag. God, you're a loser. Fat boy. Don't come get some, you bitches.
Incredible. That is so good. Tip of the hat to Rick. Tip of the hat to you, Alvy. I know we will hear from him again before the 19th. Just like I know he's got his eyes set on bringing a title to Buffalo and repping the shiny up-and-coming city as hard as he possibly can in June. Much like back in the day when Vic won. There's certain guys that you do not want to win. Because if they do, you'll be hearing about it every single day for the next year. If you hate this guy, you are going to really hate this guy winning because he's going to let you know it.
You loser. You hack. You fat ass. You sociopath. You scumbag. God, you're a loser. Fat boy. Don't come get some, you bitches.
This dude's good. We are joined by Justin Gaethje. Justin, great to have you on the show. How are you?
I'm great, man. How are you doing?
Good, dude. Good. I've got to ask, what have the last few days been like for you after an amazing performance on Saturday night? How is life right about now?
I mean, it feels good. It feels good, but, this is a great opportunity. I went back to the office. This was the best time for me to sell some apparel on my website. And I was back to the office on Monday and, trying to capitalize on what I did on Saturday.
Yeah, I'm not surprised to hear that at all. That's the way you do it. Listen, going back to Saturday night, Ferguson had come into that fight having won 12 straight, and yet you were dominating him from the outset. What were the first few rounds of that fight like for you, and what was your mindset going in?
Yeah, my mindset was the same as always. It's just go in there and be my best, be perfect for 25 minutes. I had thousands of minutes. And that whole time I tell myself I only got to be perfect for 25. So after the first couple rounds, I got clipped at the end of the second. So that, and being in the mindset that you're in, it kind of resets everything. I don't retain anything in the moment. It's so fast and so fast. There's nothing, no other word for it. So is it, after I watched it, I was on point. It was a masterpiece. I fought a perfect fight.
I think it's amazing. That's really interesting to me that you said, like, I've trained for this, not prepared for this with thousands and thousands of minutes. I just need 25 perfect ones. The other part of the mindset, Justin, you had told your coaches, quote, you're not going to like it, but I am ready to die tonight. That's the mentality you have to come in there with, end quote. It's an amazing mentality. I can remember the first time I heard a fighter tell me that. Ronda Rousey, way, way, way back in the day, right when she hit the scene, she told me in an interview, I am prepared to die before I lose this fight. It might be a figure of speech, but watching the way you go about your work, it seems real to me. Was that a Tony Ferguson thing? You need that to fight a guy like that? Or do you have that mentality every single time you get in the cage?
No, every fight. There's a chemical release in your body. In life and death situations, someone breaks into your house at night. It's fight or flight. It's the most truest thing in every human being. You know, I've worked my whole life to hone that skill, and you know, I'm so comfortable. It's the most peaceful that I've ever been, the most peace I've ever experienced in life. When I found comfortability in that adrenaline. It's the truest thing, you know, to be able to go in there and perform under that pressure and under those circumstances. You know, it's not inhuman, but it's a human trait that is very rarely experienced in life. Like I said, near-death experiences, people in war. And it allows me to not hesitate. And that's, you know, it's a very comfortable place for me.
How did you get there? How did you find peace, comfort, and tranquility in that moment with that incredible adrenaline release?
Probably resting my whole life. I'm sure it was just, you know, a little bit at a time. But, you know, wrestling your whole life, you know, I won things that I should have never won. I lost things I should have never lost. And life was always the same the next day. You know, my family always loved me. You know, and I always got to go again. So losing isn't a factor ever. It's not even a thing I think about, winning or losing, but, just the pure competition. I found so much peace in the competition part. And that's just through, I don't know. Probably being a little bit crazy and training my butt off.
Probably so. Justin Gaethje joining us. I guess losing is not a factor, except it is in one sense. After the fight, you said, quote, "I had to lose to change. You can't fix what's not broken. We figured out what was wrong. I was getting hit too much. I was getting, to be honest with you, I was having too much fun. Both times I lost, I became complacent because I was having so much fun," end quote. Now, to me, that's serious knowledge. Like, a lot of guys would keep on doing the same thing because they were having fun and the fans love an entertaining fighter. When did you realize you had to change, and then what did you change?
So it's crazy. I've been thinking about that the last few days. And, there was never a time when I told myself something or me and my coach had a conversation. I think it was purely me making a choice. It was my choice to go out there and fight the way that I had fought. I clearly didn't just all of a sudden come upon the skills that I showed on Saturday night. I've had those skills, and we've been working on them for 9 years. But I, you know, it was a choice, plain and simple. You know, it was so simple. Ever since I lost, you know, I just purely chose to fight different and be more cautious. And yeah, so like I said, we've never really talked about it. It's just kind of just happened. You know, the fact that I fought for 25 minutes really allowed me to see the difference in the way that I fight. The last three, you know, before that were quick knockouts, so I wasn't sure. You know, I knew something was different, but I wasn't sure yet. And now, yeah, you know, again, just to be that comfortable that for 25 minutes, I didn't know I could fight that long. I had no idea. I surprised myself that night, honestly, by my performance.
Justin Gaethje joining us. So what's it like? Obviously, a lot of fighters, a lot of athletes feed off the energy of the crowd. Of course, you know, your performers and your athletes. What was it like to fight in an empty arena?
I mean, for me, I think it helped in the sense that I'm sure, you know, so being able to, you know, again, going back to the dying part, you know, that allows you to go to such a cold place, you know, a cold place in that, you know, there's not a factor or a sound, a light, a word, you know, an emotion that can deter your mindset. And I think that I probably get more aggressive in and take more chances when there would be a crowd there. So I think the crowd not being there allowed me to become, you know, more in control, if in a sense. So I think it helped me.
Just let me ask you something. Like, you would never, I know you, and with your belief in yourself, and frankly, my personal opinion, I can't see you being in this position, but it's such a violent, violent game and things happen. Like, when you see what happened to Anthony Smith and the fact that his corner did not throw in the towel, you've made this very clear. I'm willing to die out there. If you were having a bad night and you were on the wrong end of a beating like that, where do you come out? Would you want your corner to protect you from yourself because you're not willing to quit and you're willing to die? What would you want your corner to do?
Yeah, so, you know, I've had this conversation. My coach, not too long ago, you know, he was going to maybe not be able to make it to a fight for some reason. And he said, I want you to go home and I want you to mentally prepare for an instance in which I can't be at the fight. You know, maybe I die a couple weeks before, or I get, you know, sick, or something happens with my family and I can't be there. And, you know, I was like, I'm not going to do that, because if that was to happen, I would not fight. You know, usually he's the only person that I trust. He's at every single one of my workouts. Your coach should know you better than yourself. And, you know, I've given him 100% go ahead to stop a fight. You know, he has to protect me from myself. I don't want to die. You know, I need to be protected from myself at some time. And Anthony asked for help, I believe. And I think his coaches didn't do him a favor. I think they sent him out when they shouldn't have. You know, I think Tony probably shouldn't have answered the bell in the fifth. You know, it's a championship fight, so you probably let him go out there. You maybe give him 1 minute, but, man, you got to be really close to making that choice. So that's where I sit on it. I full-heartedly trust in my coach. He's you know, if you watch the fight, you could see the advanced level that my coach is. So he's done it before to Nate Marquardt. Nate Marquardt, you know, he said, I got nothing left. And as soon as he said nothing left, he didn't say, can you keep going? You know, do you want to keep going? As soon as those words came out of his mouth, he said, fight's off. Fight's off, and he told the doctor to stop the fight. And so that's the trust I have in him, and I know that I need to be protected for myself.
Right. We're talking about Trevor Whitman, your coach. Justin Gaethje is joining us for a few more moments. Listen, after you win on Saturday, Conor McGregor was making a bunch of noise on Twitter about wanting to fight you. He tweeted, quote, Justin, there is no danger with a man that hugs legs. We all know. Try and dance around the real threat. All you want, I'm going to bleeping butcher you. Your teeth, I'm going to put them on a bleeping necklace. Speak on my skills as a father. You are bleeping dead, end quote. I know you saw that. Justin, what was your reaction to it?
Yeah, I mean, I had not one. I've been calling him out, you know, for 2 years. When I started getting on this win streak, he was always right there in front of me in the rankings. I feel that if you win, you should fight somebody in front of you. If you lose, you should fight someone behind you. So he was the fight I was calling for, and it's crazy, you know. I asked for this, you know. I asked for it so many times. I asked just to have a say in my destiny, and. You know, now I hold all the cards. It's crazy to be in a position where I have a choice to fight between Conor McGregor and Khabib Nurmagomedov right now. That's a great spot. There's 550-some-odd athletes on this roster, and every single one of them would want to trade spots with me. I am in a beautiful spot. To have McGregor on his knees begging for a fight, you know, it's unfathomable 2 months ago. So it's fun. I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying every bit of it.
I was just going to say, what's it like for you to hear this guy practically begging to fight you now? What's that feel like?
It's awesome. It's so, you know, it's such a testament to my hard work. That's all it is. You know, I never asked for something I didn't deserve. And I earned this. You know, this was the UFC picks and chooses a lot of times who they want to market. And now I just dropped a bomb, you know, and they don't have a choice. I made them choose me. So it's cool.
Justin Gaethje joining me for a few more moments. The expectation is you'll fight Khabib next. There was that news the other day that his father, who also trains him, is in the hospital at the moment. So is the plan, your plan, still to fight Khabib in your next fight?
Yeah, I mean, we both said September. But, you know, I can't even begin to sympathize because I can't even put myself in those shoes that he's in right now. You know, all I can do is pray that his father, you know, recovers and comes back. I know his dad is the reason why, you know, Dagestan, Russia, and those guys in that area are in the UFC. You know, he started it and he's pushed it so far over there. So, you know, I'm just going to, you know, we're going to let time pass. It's not something I want to, you know, try and guess what's going to happen. You know, that's going to have to play out as it's supposed to. And then I think we're both going to be ready to fight in September.
Hey, really quickly, you mentioned how much time you put in. I've got to ask you this before I let you go. After high school, you worked 7 days a week, 12 hours a day in a copper mine. What was that job like? What was a normal day in the mine like?
Yeah, and it was an hour back and forth. So I was actually getting paid $7.14. And I was the B, you know, I did the grunt work, all the heavy lifting, all the cleaning of all the dirt. We worked in a mine in Arizona. It was 120 degrees. You know, it was 105 degrees outside, but down in the pit, you know, it was 120, 125 degrees. Sun was killing you. It's hard work. Hard work. I can't believe these guys do it. You know, I was part of a special crew, and these guys do it for 365 days. It's absolutely crazy.
A couple of dudes you knew said, hey, man, you're going to be right back here. You can try and leave, but you're going to be right back here. Did you remember that? Did you use that as fuel?
Yeah, there's two guys. They said, you know, you'll be right back. And, you know, it wasn't what I needed, but, man, it was fuel. I was always going to be where I'm at right now.
Did you ever find those two dudes? What are they? Are they still there?
No, I haven't. I know their name, though.
And they know yours. I think they got a pretty good idea what you're up to now. I think they got a pretty good idea what you're doing.
It's definitely a good feeling, man. There's only a few, very few amount of people that believe that I could do this. So, you know, I love proving them right. That's the best thing.
Hey, listen, really quick. I love what you just said. Are you about proving people wrong or proving people right?
Yeah, proving people right is very refreshing.
Johnny, hang in there. I may or may not get to you. I have to get to Alvin's week that was. What's cracking? Welcome to the jungle. My name is Jim Rome. A tremendous Monday to you. Busy program for you today. Step it up now. Come on, get in here. UFC 249 was held on Saturday night, and dang.
Damn, that
was a scene.
Too much.
That was something to see.
Yeah!
Oh! Good night now.
20 seconds. Grand opening, grand closing. Thanks for coming. Nice knowing you. Kevin Ioli is joining us.
I thought it was an awesome show. The final three fights were just spectacular when you consider the significance of them.
I want to give my time to my procreation.
Just blew right past. I'm taking my talents to South
I'm
Beach.
Take my talents to South Beach.
For an all-time great explanation of future plans.
You in or out? And he said, I'm out.
If I had a chance to do it over again, I probably wouldn't change.
I mean, that part about how you wouldn't re-enter a game, not because you were hurt, but because he didn't call your name and you were disrespected as a man.
No disrespect.
And by the way, the coach made the right decision, yet you would change nothing. Scotty, come on, man. Really?
Really?
All right, Beck is joining us.
That was absolutely fascinating. Still can feel right years later because you can put yourself right back in that moment and in that mindset and feel like, yeah, this is messed up.
Kevin's already informed me that we will take Logan into the home school academy. Oh, he's easy. He just wants nothing to do with it. Apparently, Logan thinks that he can get paid as a gamer.
Paid for.
If you don't want to play that way, don't play that way.
Why not just say, that's how I did it. That was my mentality. If you couldn't do it, if that wasn't for you, break. What was going on in that moment? I wonder. Alvin.
You may have been a tyrant.
You couldn't handle me.
No one ever been or ever will be like Mike Jordan. And I'll tell you why. The guy in L.A.
Notice things have not gone so well for my guy since I gave him that golden ticket.
Double rainbow. Oh, my God.
Life is beautiful, man, and it's so is Paul Vasquez. R.I.P. Rest in prism. See you somewhere over the double rainbow. Jimmy Johnson.
Rolling into 21 and just see what comes our way.
It'll be good to see you out there. Jimmy, great to have you on the show. Thanks so much. Good luck. He didn't ghost me at the end of the interview. He is Tyler Kepner.
Who knew Donald Trump was a Tony Gwynn fan?
I believe it's Glenn Rice.
You learn something new every day.
Alvy, let's do this. Patriot. Brah. Citizen. Brah.
Come on.
And more Kyle in Green Bay meeting the ugliest group of people I've seen since the Laguna Beach belly rolled all those old dudes into your studio.
I couldn't tell if Jim went to Matt in Vancouver or Matt in Cleveland.
Global Army.
Just breathe, Matt.
West Virginia now. Alan, nice to have you. What's up? Alan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Alan.
No, you're Alan. I'm Jim.
Alan.
He said, hey. That's clearly hey, right? Clear as day, hey.
Alan.
Three say Alan, three say hey.
Hey.
And he reaches out and handed something to the ref, and the ref put it in his pocket. I was like, what the did he just get?
But I've never seen a fighter lose a tooth and then hand it to the ref, and the ref puts it in his pocket like, yo, I got you. I got you, big dog.
It's crazy.
And I know some of you guys hate to hear it, but America's hat still owns your fat, balding asses, so pipe down there.
Give him a golden ticket.
Oh, Canada.
Speaking of nuggets, it's called a transition clone. Look it up.
First off, Kyle preps Cal's beer for him.
like you would do for your wife or your girlfriend, you know. it's actually very sweet of him.
You know I was pulling for you. Jay Feely joining us. So in terms of his mindset, do you think that maybe Brady's going there because he wants to have a little bit of fun? He wants to enjoy himself?
He does always have a chip on his shoulder. Always.
Always.
Anytime people doubt him and question him, he uses that as fuel and as motivation.
Note to that fat ass. When your side salad has a Mount Everest of bacon bits on it, you've broken your diet. Dump out that lettuce and put that mountain of bacon bits on top of a bowl of nacho cheese covered taco meat, you sick pig.
Softball. Bacon bits. Medium sized cat turd. Champion brand cut off sweatpants. Empty bags of Cheetos.
Buddy Black, my guest.
We go back to the late 80s, the mighty 690. We met first time at San Diego State on the baseball field there. And I'll always remember those early days of Jim Rome, man.
Shy. Flipped over the table, pulled out guns, and put them in someone's face.
You loser. You hack.
You fat ass.
You sociopath. Scumbag.
God, you're a loser.
Fat boy.
Don't come get some, you bitches.
Me being left on hold was the best thing that ever happened to me and the worst thing to ever happen to all of you.
Justin Gaethje joining me for a few more moments.
I never asked for something I didn't deserve, and I earned this. The UFC picks and chooses who they want to market, and now I just dropped a bomb and they don't have a choice. I made them choose me.
This Gaethje, man, that was intense.
Matt says he gets down like Wilt Chamberlain in the bedroom. Wilt Chamberlain, more like A.C. Green.
Not the Rome universe.
Congratulations on everything.
I go hard in the paint because y'all can't.
Beef Wellsington.
I said what?
His what?
Spots.
Procreation.
Oh!
That's two butthole blasts.
That's an H for hilarious.
Yes, sir. It's my honor. Big fan.
Brick.
Good night now!
We are joined by Paul Azinger. Paul, it is so great to have you back. Before we get into the return of golf and Sunday's event, how are you, Paul, and everybody else around you doing in the middle of this pandemic?
Well, I hope everybody's well. Stay safe and mind your germ intake, I guess. We're all doing great, Romy. It's been a long time since I've been on the show. And, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. This TaylorMade event is going to be a nice start to try to get things back to normal. It'll be a nice exhibition between four really good players on a terrific course. And we're lucky, though, that, you know, we can live in Florida and get outside, and the course is never closed here in Florida. The clubhouses did, but I think that's made a big difference for a lot of people. Golf has.
Zinger, it's great to have you back. Yeah, the event's going to be great. I want to ask you about that in a few moments, and then I'll follow up. But we are now 27 years removed from that PGA Championship win. As you look back, what do you remember, Paul, about that final round?
It was a pretty studly leaderboard. I wasn't in the last group. I was in the second to last or third to last group. Greg Norman had the lead. He'd won the British Open a few weeks before that. But I was at the top of my game, Romy. I had 10 top threes or something in like 11 months going into that event with a few wins. I won Jack's tournament, holing out of the bunker. And I was just confident. And not only that, I was the best player in the world not to win a major. So, you know, I had butterflies on Tuesday that week. I knew I was going to be in contention. Had a big gambling game. Fred Couples and I played Watson and Raymond Floyd, and we took them to task, I remember, on Tuesday. And it was just one of those weeks I just felt the pressure the day I left on the airplane to go out to the PGA Championship. And come Sunday, when I was there, it was almost it was like a desperation. You can do this. You got to do this, you know. I just heard Justin Gaethje a minute ago. You know, he was willing to die to get in the ring, really. I believe him. I really do believe him. And I guess when you're playing, you get in a desperate place when you've had some chances to win and you let them get away. And here's another chance, and you're up against guys that got you in the past, you know, Norman and Faldo. It was a good leaderboard, and I just didn't want them celebrating at my expense, and thank goodness for me, I made enough putts. I think I shot four under the last nine holes. They said the last seven holes, actually, and got Greg in a playoff, but I tell you, I was cramping up, Romy. The pressure was real, and for me, it was, you know, it was all about the prestige. It's not to do with the cash at that point in the game. You know, you're just trying to make history, and you can't make history unless you win a major, and I think all those guys know that.
Man, that is such a great answer. Paul Azinger joining us. Just to recap that really quickly. Paul, you were regarded as the best player not to have won a major at that point, and then you're in a position, and again, on that leaderboard, you've got the likes of Greg Norman, Nick Faldo, Vijay Singh, Tom Watson, and then you did beat Norman in a playoff. What do you remember about the playoff itself?
My whole body relaxed in a playoff. I was dehydrated, though. I got a big calf cramp on number 10 green in the playoff, which is our second playoff hole. But my whole body relaxed. And, you know, I guess it relaxed. See, the challenge when you're in that kind of an intense pressure and you want to win so bad is, can your body still react in a relaxed way when your heart's beating hard enough you can feel your pulse in your fingertips, you know? And that's what it's like. And so, I don't know. It's just one of those things. I was able to relax more in the playoff. Greg and I both could have made birdie on the first hole, and then I stuffed it in there on the second hole of the playoff and missed my putt. And then he ended up missing. It's a tough way for us to finish, but it was fun. I'll tell you what, I'll never forget it.
Paul Azinger, my guest. One more thought. Justin Gaethje, you mentioned you had heard the interview. When he said, I just am able to get comfortable with that adrenaline, that enormous release of adrenaline, and I'm prepared to die if that's what it takes. I think like any great athlete, you have to find a way to manage the moment, manage your emotion, and manage the adrenaline. How do you do that?
Well, you know, he said he trusts his trainer, his coach, you know, to save him, to save his life, really. Didn't he say that?
He did.
And you know, in some ways, we trust our caddies enough to say, hey, you got to relax me. I'm so nervous I can't spit. And, you know, generally that relationship between player and caddy is a big deal, and it pays big dividends. When that, you know, you get a Stevie Williams and Tiger Woods combination, it was an intimidating duel, and they fed off each other, and those guys were hard to beat. So part of it comes from that relationship on the course. Of course, you have to be comfortable at home. You know, I got a great family, a great wife, and that helps, but you know, in the end, you dig deep. You prepared your whole life to do this. You got to out-concentrate the field. You got to think the best. And, you know, when it comes down to me against you at the very end, you know, I just always relaxed and just said, I just don't want them to celebrate at my expense. And a lot of times they did, but at least they beat me when I was relaxed.
Paul Azinger is joining us. You know, Paul, obviously golf is only a part of your story. You did an interview with Golf Week recently, and you were talking about when you received your cancer diagnosis. Paul, I've mentioned this so many times over the years on the program, but cancer is something that we are all directly or indirectly connected to. Like, everybody knows somebody who has dealt with this, or everybody knows somebody who knows somebody. My father passed, he had leukemia, so I know what this is like to get that news. When you received your cancer diagnosis, what do you remember about that moment and what went through your head?
Yeah, that was a scary time. I mean, my shoulder hurt for a long time, Jim. It hurt for 6 months. Dr. Frank Jobe, the great orthopedic surgeon who invented the Tommy John surgery, was working with the tour, and he was the guy that showed the most concern about my shoulder, and everybody else kind of thought it was tendonitis or bursitis, but he did a bone scan, and it was actually after the Skins game I played in, 1993 Skins game, and then the week after that is when I found I had cancer, and he walked in the office and sat down, and my wife and I were there, and he says, I got bad news, and in his demeanor, you know, was such. He was just a soft, gentle man with a big, big reputation and voice. And the concern on his face struck me. And when he said, you have cancer, my wife and I were just silent. And I just said, well, how do you treat it? And he said, with chemotherapy and radiation. And I got up and went to the bathroom and threw up. I mean, it freaked me out. I was probably the hottest player in the world at the time. I mean, I'd had 11 top threes in 10 months, and I had 4 wins in that period, the Tour Championship and the Major and Jack's Tournament, and it was like, wow, just like that, I wasn't going to be at the Masters or the Tournament of Champions. My whole life was changing, and you just realize I wasn't really in control. And so I think priority-wise, you just learn to love each day as it comes. And if I can be an inspiration to people, I will, and especially through this COVID thing. We just got to love every day that we get and just, you know, put ourselves where we are. If, you know, I've got such a good situation, it's hard for me to give advice. Just because I know there's a lot of people that they open their front door and they're in a hallway because they're in an apartment complex. It's tough on them, and we're just praying for them. And but you know, I got over it somehow, and thank goodness for chemotherapy and radiation.
You know, I so appreciate your thoughts on that, Paul. How about one quick follow? Like, what would you say to somebody who's listening right now, who might have just received a cancer diagnosis and feel the way you did? Like, their world's been turned upside down. They're terrified. They're in shock. They don't know what to think or what to do now.
Well, it's real easy now because it's been 25 years, 27 years since my diagnosis. And I realize now that millions and millions of people are cured from cancer. They figured out how to cure cancer. It's unbelievable. In most cases, it has to be, you know, if it's caught early, it's very curable. I've had thousands of people come to me through the years and tell me that they've been cured from of cancer. The treatment might stink. It might last 6 months or a year, and they can prolong your life for 20 years and you can have cancer the whole time. They have leukemia pills now, and it's just so different than having to put a port in your chest and have the chemo drip in. So I would say to anybody that's diagnosed, they're probably going to get it. I mean, they usually will get this cancer if it comes. And if it's caught early enough, that's why you should go get screened. If it's caught early enough, they cancer gets beat almost all the time.
Paul Azinger, my guest. I appreciate your thoughts on that, Paul. Sunday's event is going to pit Rory McIlroy against Ricky Fowler, Matthew Wolf in a four-ball skins game at Seminole. First of all, what do you make of the track? What do you make of the course?
Well, it's an old golf course. It was built in 1930, Seminole. They would have played this exhibition on a dirt road probably if you'd cut a hole in the ground for the kind of money they're going to make.
Right.
But they landed at Seminole, and it is where Hogan used to prepare to play the Masters. It's where Jimmy DeMeritt used to prepare. Jimmy DeMeritt was best friends with Jackie Burke, who's, you know, Steve Elkington's mentor. And let's see, Claude Harmon prepared there. He's got the course record 60. That's Butch Harmon's dad, Jim. And it is a wonderful Donald Ross golf course. There's no trees. It's beautifully kept, but it's got all kinds of sand dunes. It's lots of undulations. The greens are tricky. The ball scampers along, and it's going to be fun to watch them. I hope that it's light. You know, it is an exhibition. I think they're going to have a lot of fun out there. They're all going to be mic'd. We have 6 handheld cameras, which hopefully will give a great perspective of the golf course. And I think the whole world's dying to see the golf course. Anybody that loves golf, it's never been on TV before. This will be the first time that Seminole, always ranked in the top 15 in the world, and at one time was 4th best golf course in the world. And it's definitely in my top 5. This will be the first time it's ever been on television.
All right, so what do you make of the two teams? Do they feel like an even match to you?
You know, Dustin Johnson was hilarious yesterday. They asked him in the press conference about some British guy asked him about Rory McIlroy, and he said, what's your favorite thing about Rory McIlroy? What do you like about him the most? And what's the most memorable shot he's ever hit? He asked Dustin Johnson that, and Dustin said, well, everybody likes Rory, you know. I mean, nice guy, super nice guy. He's a great golfer, but, as far as the shots, I can't, you know, he thought about it for me, so I can't remember. I don't know. I can't. He's a great player. He's hit a lot of great shots. I don't remember one. And the British guy says, well, do you remember the 15-footer he made to beat you out of $10 million 2 years ago? And Dustin was like, oh, that's right. I forgot about
that.
And he totally forgot about it, I think, which cracked me up.
That is
I literally
funny.
Busted out laughing listening to that because I believed he had totally forgot. Either that or he was really just jacking with the guy asking the question. So, but those two are incredible to watch. Rory's, I think, the best player in the world. He's ranked number one, and it's deservedly so. He strikes it off the tee like nothing I've ever seen, really. Greg Norman kind of drove it like that, I guess, in our era. Tiger Woods at times. But what Rory can do with a driver separates him and sets him apart. He gives himself more wedge chances from short grass. Dustin Johnson's strength of his game is putting, is driving as well. And I think together, I mean, they should be impossible to beat, except Dustin hasn't played in like 30 or 40 days, I think it just hit these guys yesterday that this is going to be a big, big deal. It's an exhibition match, but it's the first live thing on TV, and they're going to have some butterflies. The swings, how about the uniqueness of their four swings,
right,
by the way?
I like that. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, no kidding. Matt Wolf, I heard Crenshaw say the other day, his forward press was like somebody shooting a slingshot where he kicks that whole right side in and then swings that club back to the top. It's a wonderful-looking technique. I think it's one of the coolest things going. And you know, plus his name's Wolf, which is kind of cool. So he's a heck of a player. He won NCAAs, and then his fourth tournament on the PGA Tour, yeah, he won it, eagling the last hole. He hits it a country mile, and he's been a good player for a long time. And people are asking him or questioning, writing, like, why is he in this? And I think it's put a little bit of a chip on Wolf's shoulder, and he's going to come into this exhibition kind of with a burden of proof maybe, and that'll be cool. It'll be nervous for him. I mean, this is a big deal for these guys to play in front of the cameras again. It's been a long time, and it's on a very tricky course. Ricky knows the course like the back of his hand. Wolf, at the top of his swing, his club is aiming 30 yards to the right of the target, maybe 20 yards to the right of the target. Ricky Fowler's club at the top of his swing is aiming 30 yards left of the target. I mean, their clubs are 50 yards apart at the top of their backswings. It's unbelievable. So I can't wait to watch these four guys go at it, talk about their techniques at times, but really just enjoy the golf course. See how they go around it. Hopefully the wind will blow, Jim, and we'll see a little carnage. I'd like to see one guy, maybe two guys play well. I was talking to my buddy a minute ago, but at least one or two of them have just a terrible day, because that's the kind of course that Seminole is. Those devilish bunkers are waiting for you as soon as you hit an iron. It's not quite crisp. So maybe the course will be the star, and of course they're going to raise some real money. This isn't chicken feed. There's a lot of money that's going to get raised, and you know, that's the bottom line.
I like it. Like I always say, Paul, give me an A or give me an F. I'm with you. Let's see a couple of guys just tear it up, and let's see somebody have some trouble. And by the way, Matthew Wolf, he's got nothing to apologize for. I'm really into the fact that he's going to be there, and I'm anxious to see how he does. And I think that he will show up with a chip on his shoulder. The TaylorMade Driving Relief, supported by United Health Group, starts on Sunday at 2 p.m. It's on NBC Golf Channel and NBC Sports Network. Zinger, it has been way too long. I am so glad that you and I could finally get caught up proper, that you could come back in the jungle where you belong, and it's so good to hear your voice, Paul. I really appreciate that. That was a blast.
Well, hey, I appreciate it. I heard Digger Phelps today, and I'll tell you what, it was hard following that guy up. And this Gaethje, man, that was intense.
Good night now!